think that's the secret.
Sisters and brothers in the Dharma, Namo Buddhaya. There's a hadith of the Prophet, which goes something like, God is beautiful and he loves beauty. I'm going to come up with another hadith. The Buddha is beautiful and he loves beauty. The Buddha is beautiful and he loves beauty. That's all I've got in my mind, actually, at this moment. I think I ought to just keep saying it like a mantra. The Buddha is beautiful and he loves beauty. It's Vaishakha Purnima. It's the full moon of Vaishakha. It's the traditional time on which we celebrate the Buddha's attainment of Samyak Sambodhi. And I'm sure you've know all the different accounts of the Buddha's enlightenment. I'm not going to go into all that because it's known so well. I just want to dwell to begin with, in relation to this theme of beauty, on a couple of things from around the time of the Buddha's attainment of enlightenment. The first is something that Bhante really draws out in the two Udana seminars that he did back in the 1970s, one of which, a legendary one, which was under canvas down in Cornwall somewhere. Lots of stories about that particular seminar. Were you on that, Subhuti? A buyer? No? No? Okay, you were the arranger. Yeah. Well, in the opening suttas, the Bodhi suttas of the enlightenment of the Udana, these are the suttas which end with an udana, a breathing forth of a breathing forth, an inspired utterance, an inspired saying. In the Bodhi suttas, there are a number of them. The Buddha is depicted having attained full and perfect enlightenment, Samyak Sambodhi, having seen into deeply into the nature of reality, into the nature of things. He's described as sitting for 7 days and 7 nights, enjoying the bliss of liberation, the Vimoksha Sukha, the bliss of liberation. There are a number of these suttas, so I think it might even, if you count them up, the 7 days of sitting in the bliss of liberation, it probably comes to 49, and I haven't done that, but I would imagine it does. And Bhante points out that the 7 days is really a magic number. It's indicating that the Buddha is really outside of time. The 7 days, the 7 nights, unmoving, enjoying the bliss of liberation. Completely unbounded liberation and an unbounded bliss and happiness that goes with that. And Bhante really tries to get inside, tries to imagine what is really going on in the sutta. I mean, the suttas don't tell you too much. You then get the description of the Buddha turning his attention to Pratichasamutpada, both as a principle and as applied to the Nidana, the different Nidana chains, which of course is very important, as if the Buddha is articulating to himself what he has seen. What he's seen can't be really put into words, but he's articulating to himself how this will look, if you like, particularly in relation to other people. But I'm not going to dwell on the Pratichasamutpada side of things. Bhante tries to imagine, really, what is going on, what is happening. He picks up on the fact that the Buddha describes himself in the Udanas as a Brahmin. And of course the Buddha doesn't mean it in the caste sense. Bhante even feels that perhaps that the Buddha is looking at a more archaic use of the word Brahmin. The original Brahmin was the shaman of the tribes, the shaman of the Aryans. So Bhante is saying, well, in a sense, the Buddha is like a kind of shaman. He's in the depths of the forest. He's in his rag robes, not posh, you know, canary yellow robes that you see in the art. He, you know, it's not that he's got a bump on his head and great long ears, and that's not the Buddha that Bhante evokes. He's there, the man who's gone to the forest, gone to the jungle. He's discovered this boundless freedom, this bliss of liberation. He's gone into completely uncharted, unknown territory. And, as it were, he's coming back. He's coming back and he's enjoying, yes, this bliss of liberation. Bhante says that you can be sure whatever's going on after the attainment of enlightenment, of seeing into the depths of things as they are. Bhante says, well, you can be sure there was a very, very deep absorption. A very, very deep absorption. He said, after all, what has happened? What has gone on here? The Buddha, you know, he'd been searching for enlightenment for so long. So much toil, so much effort, so much energy. And Bhante says, you can see he's really trying to describe to us what has happened. He says, it's as if the Buddha's life is like a great river that just becomes more and more concentrated and then goes off over the precipice, completely off over into the unknown. So there's this deep absorption and yes, this bliss, this unbounded bliss of liberation. And it's very interesting, the whole topic of sukha and bliss. And I'm sure there's a connection with beauty. You can make your own connections. Leading up to the enlightenment, for example, the discovery of the middle way is really to do with bliss. It's really to do with bliss. Yes, he takes solid food and drink and so on. But the realization that he has is that he's been repressing the pleasure that is generated by skillfulness. He's regarded pleasure, even the pleasure that is produced by skillfulness, as a snare. And when he recollects that famous incident in the rose apple, under the rose apple tree, what he recollects is the pleasure born of skillful states. And he thinks, maybe that is the way forward. Maybe that is what I need. There's something really missing in his life. The kind of fuel, I suppose, of Dharma life. The sukha, the bliss generated through skillfulness, skillful states. So that's one of the reasons why he takes, you know, solid food and cleans himself up, gets himself together to find his way forward. It's interesting too to observe that Ashvaghosha, the 2nd century Sanskrit poet, who knows what traditions he was in receipt of, they're not found, as far as I know, in any Pali texts. He describes the rose apple tree experience in a bit of a different way, extremely beautifully, extremely vividly in the Buddhacharita, the Acts of the Buddha. He describes the Buddha going with friends for a ride in the jungle, the Buddha-to-be. And he goes off alone. He just wants to be alone. And he sits under this tree. And it's not his father that he's watching plough the field. It's an old farmhand ploughing this field. And Siddhartha notices how the ground is being cut up, how the insects and the worms are being cut up. He notices the toil of the bullock, the toil and the bent back of the man ploughing the field. And he looks and he's overwhelmed with compassion. It's so vivid. It reminded me of looking at something like a Bruegel painting when I first read this. He feels this incredible love and compassion. He reflects how piteous this is, how terrible this is. But the effect, very interesting, the effect is to enter dhyana. The effect is to enter dhyana. It's as if it's not just a vision of that person, those beings suffering. It's like a vision into the suffering of life. and it produces in him this experience of absorption and dhyana. So perhaps he's not just recollecting the bliss that goes with the first dhyana. Perhaps it's also a recollection of the actual origins of his quest. What he was really concerned with was not just the answer to his own sufferings, but the sufferings woven into life itself. And the Mahasatchika Sutta, which describes his recollection of the importance of bliss, has this wonderful passage where it's, you can see the beginnings of enlightenment happening, where he enters into the first dhyana. He enjoys its pleasure, but he has the awareness not to become ensnared by that pleasure. He has that mindfulness, so it opens into the second dhyana. He enjoys that second dhyana with all that surging inspiration, but knows that it's not a place to stay and become ensnared by it. It opens to the third dhyana and so on, even unto the seeing of things as they really are. And even after attaining the great bliss of liberation, the compilers of the sutta or even the Buddha in his teaching makes the point, but even this bliss of Buddhahood, I did not allow it to intoxicate my mind. So it's a bliss path, the path to enlightenment, resulting in the bliss of liberation. The Buddha's experiences of this, well, in the end, I suspect if it is the bliss of liberation, it's, I'm going to use the word, a non-dual bliss. A bliss without subject and object. A bliss without self and other. A bliss on the inside. A bliss on the outside, so to speak. There's a wonderful verse that's in the Hevajra Tantra, very important verse in the Tantric tradition, which is describing the effects of the third Abhisheka, the knowledge of the Dakini. And the verse goes like this: when the person who's had that Abhisheka, when they're describing the experience of that bliss, they say, where there is no beginning, middle or end, where there is no becoming and no stopping, oh, there, in that supreme bliss, there is no self, there is no other. And that's very interesting because it's making a connection, I think, between bliss and love, bliss and compassion. The Buddha's experience of the bliss of liberation is also the experience of great compassion. The experience, the unleashing, if you like, of great compassion. I don't think that the Buddha's compassion is simply a matter of just contemplating the sufferings of the world and feeling sorry about it. There's an abundance to the Buddha's compassion. An abundance to the Buddha's compassion. And as I was saying to Subhuti today, years ago, Bhante reminded me, after I'd given a talk on beauty, that William Blake once said, beauty is abundance. Beauty is abundance. The Buddha's enlightenment is abundant. Compassion is abundance. It's not impoverishment. It's not feeling the impoverishment of beings. Or if it is feeling the impoverishment of them, it's responding with abundance. So on the outside, there is love and compassion. On the inside, there is great bliss. There's a wonderful verse by the great Maharashtrian saint Tukaram. A wonderful verse. I wish I could sing it in Marathi, but I can't. But the verse goes something like this: he who identifies with the battered and beaten, know him as a saint. The saint's mind is like butter, soft on the outside and soft on the inside. Really love that. And in another place, Atisha, the great Indian teacher who did so much for the Dharma in Tibet, once said, when you know shunyata, your body, speech and mind react with pleasure, with bliss, like dissolving fresh butter into hot barley soup, or like cotton that has been softened. You become soft. You soften the relationship between self and other. And there is an outpouring of love and compassion. You know, if you really want to know whether or not somebody has shunyata, has seen shunyata, are they soft? Are they softening in relation to everything around them? Are they loving? Are they compassionate? Are they courteous? Are they really taking you in? That's the sign. That's the sign of shunyata. And we know as well that the Buddhas had that wonderful vision. He doubted whether he could communicate his experience, but he looked again at life, at all living beings. And it's very interesting. The looking is with the Buddha eye. It's with the Buddha chakshu. It's not with the ordinary eye. It's not with the deva eye, the eye of meditation. It's not even with the wisdom eye. It's with the Buddha eye. I take that to mean that actually what he's seeing of us, cannot really be put into any words. It can't be articulated, really. He uses an as if. He has to use metaphorical language. He has to use poetry. As if I was looking at a great lake of red and blue and white and pink and yellow. Maybe that I'm going a bit further than the text, but never mind. Lotuses pushing up out of the lake. Some buds, for sure, but some pushing forth, showing themselves, revealing themselves. And then he knew he could communicate. There was something, if you like, of him, of enlightenment, of the bliss of liberation in all beings. His beauty being reflected in the beauty of all. His fully opened lotus, if you like, sees the opening lotuses of us, of all beings. And then there's compassion. And of course, after seeing that, he just went. He just leaves the forest. He leaves the Mahavana, the great forest. And he goes and communicates. He's so full of energy. And you get the impression of the Buddha's communication in the early years of the Sasana. There's a kind of electricity in the air. You know, we know the story of the five ascetics and so on. But what about the communication to Yasha and his friends? You know, Yasha was just a playboy in a rich merchant's family. You know, real interest in Dharma. He wakes up in the middle of the night horrified by the sight of, you know, this party or the dregs of this party in his harem, you know, with all the musicians, with not one man among them. Snoring and, you know, making all these sort of grotesque shapes lit by in this one candle lit gloom. He just starts shouting, "It's horrible, it's horrible, it's terrible, it's horrible," running out to the deer park and just running until finding this voice, you know, in the midst of the park, just saying, "This is not horrible. This is not terrible." And then calming down, sitting, becoming drawn in, fascinated by this man sitting there, talking with him, communicating with him. Even after he's gained stream entry and the Buddha notices his dad's coming along to find him, and if his dad comes, he'll sort of pull him back from full enlightenment. So the Buddha does something tantric. He kind of makes him disappear to carry on his training inside this sort of sphere while he talks to his dad, gets his dad up to stream entry so that when he appears, his dad will let him go forth. Wonderful, magical stories. But, you know, in the end, it's Yasha, his friends, all these playboys. You get the impression that the Buddha is just so fascinating, so lovely, and the youth and even their parents and families, they just want to go for refuge. They just want to, you know, follow this man. They just want to spread the Dharma for the happiness, the bliss, and welfare of all beings. So much so that the Buddha was accused of putting spells on people to draw them away from their families. He was that alluring, that fascinating, that lovely. And I think this is an aspect of the Buddha, the Buddha's beauty, his sort of magnetic attraction, that perhaps is, we don't reflect on anywhere nearly enough. The other day I was listening to a talk by an older member, a good talk by an older member, about Bahya Sutta. And of course, when the Bahya Sutta is mentioned, you just get in the seen, only the seen, in the heard, only the heard, in the imagined, only the imagined. You don't get what happens before. You know the story of Bahya. He's on the seashore down on the west coast near Bombay, and he's practicing and thinks, am I liberated? Am I an arahant? And fortunately, he's got a relation who's a deva, who notices his delusion and says, no, you're not an arahant. You're not even on that path. And he says, well, if I'm not an arahant, who is an arahant and who's on that path? In the far-off interior regions, lovely phrase, there is a man called the Buddha. He is an arahant. Go to him. And you know the story. Bahya is so determined. He gets over to Shravasti very, very quickly. And he sees, eventually tracks down the Buddha, doing his begging round, collecting alms in Shravasti. And the text said, and this is such an important detail, I think it's really describing how Bahya is seeing the Buddha. How he's seeing the Buddha walking, wearing his patched robes, and no doubt his lean, glowing, lovely glowing brown skin. We don't know, he might not have, apparently Bhante says that the monks only used to shave every couple of weeks, maybe had some stubble, something like that, but he looks fabulous. He looks wonderful. The text says, comely he was. Comely he was. Goodly to look upon. With senses calm and peaceful. Like a well-trained elephant. That can be a bit odd for our Western sensibility. But elephants are astonishingly beautiful creatures. You know, when you see them pacing along. This massive, beautiful creature from another world. So he sees the beauty of the Buddha. And we can imagine he wouldn't have just gone up to him and asked him to teach. He would have bowed at his feet. He would have surrendered. He might not have said Buddhang Saranangacchami. He might not have had that language. But that's what he would have done. He asks for a teaching urgently. Seems to know that there isn't much time to receive the teaching. And it's then that the Buddha gives him the essential instruction. In the seen, only the seen. In the heard, only the heard. In the imagined, only the imagined, and so on. But who's saying it? Bahya is not reading it in a book. He's looking at the Buddha, saying, in the seen, only the seen. In the heard, only the heard. The Buddha is teaching. The Buddha is in front of him. He's taking Buddha darshan. You know, there's the vision of the Buddha in all his beauty. Surely that is one of the reasons why. In that moment, perhaps the main reason why, in that moment, he breaks through. He is liberated, fully liberated in that moment. It's not just the words. It's the Buddha. It's the beauty, the glory, the tremendous, overwhelming presence of the Buddha that's there in the teaching. I mean, maybe it's even possible, I don't know, that Bahya, when he was meditating on that phrase, he was actually imagining the Buddha. Actually imagining the Buddha. I say this because after I was ordained, and my ordination was very, very vivid to me, when I sat down to do my sadhana, to chant the mantra, all I saw was Bhante. All I saw was Bhante. I actually said, hang on, you're not supposed to be there. It's supposed to be foolish me. You know, it should be the Buddha or Bodhisattva. It was Bhante. It was the man who gave the teaching, who gave the word, who gave the mantra in all his, well, beauty and vividness. So we need to constantly remember this when we're reading the text, when we're recollecting the text, bringing the text to mind, recollect the Buddha's presence, the Buddha's beauty. So I said earlier that the Buddha enjoys the bliss of liberation, bliss as it were on the inside, bliss on the outside, which is compassion. I talked about the softening that comes with that liberation. I want to just dwell a little bit on that before I close. I want to go to another passage in the tradition, which actually comes towards the end of the Buddha's life. It comes in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And it comes in a number of conversations, very mysterious conversations that the Buddha is having with Ananda. It includes the conversations about the eight vimokshas, including the liberation called the beautiful. I don't know if that's significant. But in one of these discussions, the Buddha says, Ananda, there are these eight great assemblies, kshatriyas, warriors, Brahmins, householders, summoners, you know, the wanderers, the ascetics, the devas of the four great kings, the devas of the 33 gods, and the Brahma devas. I have been to all of these assemblies. And before I go into those assemblies, I adopt the appearance of the being in those assemblies. And I sit with them. And I converse with them. I talk in their language. And they are sitting, listening, and they are wondering, who is this? Is this a deva or a man with us? Who is this being communicating with us? And then I leave that assembly, and they say to themselves, who was that who was with us? Was it a deva or was it a man? It's a very mysterious passage, and thankfully, our wonderful teacher has commented on this passage in a wonderful lecture called The Disappearing Buddha. The Disappearing Buddha, that I'd really recommend. And one of the things, of course, it's describing is the Buddha's compassion, his amazing anukampa, his trembling with this ability to, yes, naturally go outside of himself, to become the other, so to speak. But he's also at the same time always the Tathagata, always the thus come, the thus gone, always the Buddha. And yet he's with, deeply, whoever he's with, and yet a mystery at the same time, because he is the Tathagata. Great, you know, lesson and teaching for us, and how we must practice these incredibly broad powers of empathy in order to communicate the Dharma to people. But it's remarkable, isn't it, that it's not just to these different kinds of people. He's in the realm of the gods, adopting their appearance, speaking their language. How do the gods speak? The devas of the 33, the Brahmas. What does that mean? Perhaps it means that the Buddha who is beautiful, who loves beauty, will clothe himself always in what is beautiful, because the devas especially are astonishingly, sublimely beautiful to us. The Buddha will always adopt what is beautiful. Reality will always want to adorn itself with beauty, to communicate to us, to break through to us. So perhaps, maybe, this is the origins of the Bodhisattva figures, something like that, that have come down to us. Perhaps enlightenment taking these beautiful forms, perhaps it's related to this particular incident. Another episode from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is Bhante's pointed out, is the Buddha is in where is he? He's in Vaishali, and he's in a mango grove, I think, in Vaishali, and the Lichavi youths have come to see him. So these literary youths, they're the kind of the lads of the time, you know, of the day. You know, they've got their latest fashions on, and it's described in the text. Some of them wear blue gear, blue ornaments, blue makeup. Wow. And they're in their chariots, and some of them are the same in red. Red makeup, red gear, red ornaments, yellow, green. And they're there coming. You know, they've, you know, that somebody's probably said, hey, the Buddha's in town. We need to go and get a blessing. Let's really get dolled up. Let's really look good for the Buddha. Let's really show ourselves. So I don't forget, tonight we've got a puja. So how about really getting dolled up for the Buddha? Because I say this because the Buddha, and he's a very old man now, of course, he just looks at these literary youths coming. And he said, bhikkhus, take a look. Take a look. If you haven't seen the heaven of the 33, if you haven't seen Indra's heaven, have a look at these. Have a look at the literary youths. Look, they are just like the heaven of the 33. And Bhante's comment on that is, that's an exclamation. It's the Buddha's immediate response to beauty, to the beauty of these, dolled up, beautifully made up, fashionable literary youth. So, yes, let's do that tonight. So there's that immediate response. So the Buddha is beautiful and he loves beauty. And when we recollect the Buddha, we need to be looking for the beauty of the Buddha. There are all sorts of meditations describing the recollection of the Buddha. There's all sorts of visualization practices. But perhaps the place we should always begin is with beauty, and to respond with beauty. You know the story, you probably all know the story of Ananda after the Parinirvana, going back to Shravasti, going to the Gandakuti, the perfume chamber, perfume because it was filled with flowers. People brought flower offerings and garlands for the Buddha. They decked that place like that. Ananda goes into the Gandakuti. He sweeps the floor, he lays out a mat, he throws away the old garlands, he puts out fresh water, and he sits. He sits there. He sits there as if the Buddha is there, as if the Buddha is still present. He even says, homage, namo, to the Gandakuti, hail to the perfume chamber. Buddha Ghosha says he did this because of his excessive attachment to the Buddha. Yes, of course, his excessive attachment to the Buddha. And that excessive attachment is so important and so good. Because how else will enlightenment come to Ananda? How else will he think of enlightenment but with the Buddha, in his Kalyanamitra, in his teacher? He wants always to take darshan of the Buddha. I know all the official stories about Ananda being attached and, you know, not making it to enlightenment and all the rest of it. I don't believe it. I think that's all propaganda. It's the most human thing to do, to recollect your teacher, to continually take darshan of your teacher, whether he's present or not. And to conclude, I just want to mention, I had an understanding into what recollection of the Buddha, Guru Yoga even, really is. Many years ago in India, I was on a lecture tour down in Kolhapur district, southwest Maharashtra, with the wonderful order member named Shakyanand, the bliss of the Shakyan. Shakyanand was probably the fattest order member, probably ever. He was really huge, great big chubby cheeks and very, very brown, and a very, very beautiful man who I love deeply. And I love being with him. And when we got to Kolhapur, I said, Shakyanand, how many lectures are we doing? And we had 4 days. Oh, Paramavadra, we're doing 18. So determined. And it's all because of Bhante's blessing. That's why we're doing this. Anyway, we stayed in his place. And he was the only order member there. And Bodhisen, my translator, we were with Shakyanand. And Shakyanand had this little corner of this room. And in the corner of this room, there was a little shrine and there were two cushions. And Shakyanand said, "This is where I have my chapter meeting every week, every Tuesday." Tuesday was chapter night in India then. And Bodhisattva and I said, "Oh, Shakyanand, how can you have chapter meeting? You are on your own." He said, "No, I'm not on my own." He was ordained by Bhante, had much contact with Bhante. He said, "I'm not on my own. Every Tuesday, Bhante comes. Bhante sits with me. We have chapter. This is my chapter." And I understood what recollection of the Buddha is. It's the most human thing. What recollecting the teacher is, what guru yoga is. It's nothing to do with tantric techniques. It's bringing the teacher into loving consciousness. It's bringing the teacher, the beauty of the teacher, you know, imagining having him present always with you in whatever you do. And of course, we go on doing that with our teacher, with the Buddha. Even now, even after all these centuries, we can bring the Buddha to mind. We can bring the Buddha into consciousness. So, one final thing, one of the things that goes with recollecting the beauty of your teacher, the beauty of the Buddha, is gratitude. Not just gratitude, but a part of gratitude, the desire to be generous with the life that you've been given. And with Shakyanand again, I remember on this tour, we got to a place outside of a village, and there were all these beautiful Indian women in their best saris, beautiful coloured saris, forming a line as we went into the village. And they were sprinkling the ground with water from these great big brass pots. And I was about to step forward, and Shakyanand said, "No, remember, this is for Bhante. This is all for Bhante. Only Bhante has made this possible. It's through his blessing."